Welcome to this event. I'm Eric Burdoff. I'm the director of the Institute of Global Affairs here. I, as some of you know, have a lot of interest in the topic of tonight's presentation. So Poland came from basically nowhere. It came from, you had a long period of backwardness, was very poor, and within the course of one generation, went to become a high-income country. I certainly, in my generation, I witnessed this. I traveled a lot in Poland before 89 and can attest to the poverty, the backward agriculture, the incredible environmental destruction that many parts of Poland had. And you know, it did remarkably well, and also weathered the financial crisis surprisingly well, maybe. And you know, Warsaw today is an entrepreneurial hotbed, but it goes much beyond Warsaw. It's a very dynamic economy, and I think in this lifetime or this generation, it has not erased corruption, but certainly brought it down from levels that were extremely high to levels that are on par with most countries in Western Europe. So, and the whole government has been thoroughly reformed and reorganized, and so it's a different country in many ways today than it was just a generation ago. At the same time, there has been also a reversal in some sense, also very unexpected perhaps in terms of the nature of politics, the nature of policies. And you know, I used to say that to people, you know, you should, if you want to really see where there is excitement about the European project, I said go to Warsaw. I mean, this is the place where there is some forward thinking and some enthusiasm about the European project. Of course, this was during the global financial crisis, and there was still this perception in Warsaw that Poland, the future was in Europe, and Poland would be an important player in Europe, and it could be part of shaping Europe's future, and that was the atmosphere at the time. But of course, today it's somewhat different, and we want today to talk about both these sides of Poland, but of course we should definitely give credit to this quite remarkable book, I would say, Europe's the Growth Champion, Insight from the Economic Rise of Poland. So Marcin Piętowski here has been in the World Bank for, I don't know actually how long, but
a decade now,
almost a decade, and been a senior economist there. And he took a year or even more, maybe, off to write this book, and that's, I think, has helped the book's readability and also his ability to say things that maybe he couldn't have said otherwise. In any case, it goes way back in time, but it also points to the future. So it's a very interesting book, and you're going to have a chance to present it quite extensively, I hope. So that's good. But I also very glad to have Sergei Guriev here, probably also quite familiar to you. And I've said it before, but you know, one thing important in life is to get good successors, and he's been my successor at the EBRD and has done a lot to build the research group at the EBRD, and of course before that he was at Sciences Po. Well, he's still a professor at Sciences Po, but he's on leave. And before that, of course, rector of the New Economic School in Moscow. And Judith, among others, have been following this institution and knows very well what Sergei has contributed to that school, and despite all the maybe not so positive things happening in Russia, that school is still thriving and producing fantastic students and also very interesting research and plays a role in a very difficult policy environment. So anyhow, I think Sergei is going to focus more on the second aspect of thinking, looking at what's happened to politics, maybe not just in Poland, but looking at the phenomenon of the kind of political reversal in Central Eastern Europe, where Poland has been very much on the front of that change. Anyhow, without further ado, Marcin, the floor is yours. Take it away.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Dzień dobry to all the polls that came in. Thank you, Eric, for putting it together. Really appreciate it. And Sergei for coming. It's obviously a great honor and privilege and a pleasure to be here with you today to share a story. I want to share with you a story of a country that has been a perennial underachiever for all of its history, a country that has been economically backward, peripheral, a couple of steps back behind the West for all of its history, and a country that over the last 30 years, against many odds, because there will be very few people that would put any money on Poland back in 1989, a country that has become by far the fastest growing economy in Europe, Europe's growth champion, and also the fastest growing economy in the world among economies with a similar level of income, middle income and high income. And the reason I wrote the book is, there it is, for three major reasons. Why, first, I wanted to explain why Poland and Central and Eastern Europe, because Poland is a good proxy for the whole of the region, and let me call it Eastern Europe, even though it's actually CEE. I'm trying to explain why is it that these countries never really developed and had missed every single opportunity to catch up with the West. During the Industrial Revolution, during the interwar period, during communism, time after time, all of these countries really never made it. And I am using this example of Poland and Eastern Europe to build a larger theory of the holy grail of economists, which is what is it that makes countries rich and what is it that keeps them poor? Then I move into the second part, where I'm trying to explain what were the specific drivers of what made Poland successful for the first time ever. Because in many ways, it's a Hollywood-style miracle of a country that has never really been doing well economically, and suddenly all things came together. So I'm explaining what are the short-term factor and the long-term factor that made it possible. And the last part is, and I think Sergei will also talk more about it, will this success continue? And if not, what is it that we need to do for Poland and for the rest of Eastern Europe to continue growing and converge with Western Europe for the first time ever, because they've never been there? You with me? All right. So I like a quote from, one of my favorite quotes from Napoleon is a quote that says, history is a set of lies that everyone agreed upon. All countries create certain myths, idealized picture of their past, and Poland is not different. Some of you Poles in the audience, you would immediately recognize the map from 1600s, where Poland was the largest country in Europe, stretching from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. And this is what we taught in our historical books. But we never really look at that chart, which shows the level of income per capita in Poland in a period from 17th century up until the end of communism, which shows that throughout all of these 400 years, Poland's economy has always stagnated, and an income on an average Pole has never exceeded about half of what it was in the West. And again, there was a stagnation that meant the country missed every opportunity to catch up through the 30 years war, industrial revolution, interwar period. Every single time it did not work. So the question is, why? Why has this country done so badly for so long? And this is where I go into trying to explain the drivers of underdevelopment. This is a village in Poland in 1930s, not exactly London, if you ask me. And I'm looking at this to try to see what is it that explains Poland's and Eastern European underdevelopment, which echoes of which we are facing even today. And what I do is I borrow from the concept of Acemoglu, Johnson and Robinson that talk about two types of economies, extractive and inclusive economies. Extractive economies are those where the few rule the country for the benefit of the few. Inclusive are countries where many rule for the benefit of many. And there is the sort of the definition that they provide on extractive political institutions and economic institutions. My point is that Poland, if you had a checklist, would actually, you would be able to click every single part for Poland among all of these political and economic indicators. In other words, Poland was par excellence an extractive society all the way up till 1939. How would it show up? It would show up in a way that the Polish elites, so there was gentry and aristocracy, a few percent of the society, would ensure that the rest of the society would never have a chance to flourish, would never have a chance to grow, because that would mean that they could become rich, they could become powerful, they could have a role in the political system and could undermine the status quo. So the elites, and this is actually a proxy for a lot of countries around the world even today, ensured that Poland was the weakest state in Europe. It has the lowest rate of tax revenue among all of its peers in Europe. During the whole period, even in 1936, its tax revenue per capita was actually much lower than among its peers. And it was not by accident, it was by design. The point of the elites was to keep the state weak so that they would have the ultimate power. A little bit, Poland was like a Tea Party dream, if you remember these American guys who sort of disappeared, luckily, but you never know. They also ensured that no one had access to education. As you can't see these charts perhaps from the back, but the bottom line is that in 1750, only 5% of Poles were literate, where at the same time, the Dutch were almost universally literate. And again, it was not by accident. The differences in per capita terms were not that significant. It was by design. There was no reason for the elites to invest in education of all the other parts of the society that could endanger their log on power. And finally, stunted growth of cities. The Polish gentry did everything to ensure that the merchants, the bourgeoisie, and the urban class would never emerge. One of the good evidence of how they succeeded is that in 1800s, Poland only had three cities with more than 10,000 inhabitants versus 78 in France. I'm showing this, there's much more evidence, but the point is there was an extractive society in every single way with a small group of Polish conquistadors that conquered the rest of the society and ensured that they could never really get ahead. What it also mattered is these bad institutions were also embedded in a bad culture, a culture of the elites that was anti-development, anti-intellectual, and anti-innovation. And I could give you a lot of evidence, but I will just show you two paintings, one by Rembrandt, actually both of them by Rembrandt, but one of them of a Dutch gentleman and the other one of a Polish nobleman. See the difference? Polish elites looked, thought, acted, behaved much different than Western peers. And you can argue, and I make this argument in the book, that even if the institutions were much better, more Western than they actually were in practice, the culture that was just so anti-development would have undermined these good institutions in any way. So that brings me to this larger theory of why I'm trying to universalize the Polish case and try to say what makes countries rich, what makes them poor. And I'm leveraging the work, again, of Acemoglu and Robinson and their point about how virtually assets and how money affects the political and economic system. And what I do is that there's one small issue with this nice intellectual framework of Acemoglu and Robinson, which is they are saying that extractive societies are poor and inclusive societies become rich, the only thing that they do not really discuss is how you move from one place to the other. They do discuss this for a few countries, like UK, France, Netherlands, or Botswana, where they argue that it was internal revolutions that made the switch, but they do not cover all the other examples. And today, there are 44 high-income countries around the world, as defined by the World Bank, 44, minus Qatar's of the world, because it's oil, and minus some small Bahamas. So 44 countries. And so what I did in the book, and I looked at each one of them, and what I saw, that the, virtually in every single case, the way you moved from a pre-modern feudal anti-development society is because of violence that would eliminate the old pre-modern elites, and this violence most of the time took the form of an external intervention or external pressure. Without violence, it was almost none of these countries would make the switch, and these 44 countries made the switch to an inclusive economy, which then affected political, economic institutions, and the economic outcomes. So what I'm trying to do is extending Acemoglu's to show what are the critical elements of moving from one equilibrium to another, and it's possible that you can also, it's usually a one-way street. Once you become inclusive, you never lose being inclusive. But perhaps America or United States could be the one where they move from being exclusive to extractive. Who knows? They are good on their way to achieving it. And the one thing that characterizes all the high-income countries today, all 44, four of them, these are the black dots here on the chart, is that they are all democratic. This chart shows how democratic they are, with the exception of Singapore, and they have low or medium levels of income inequality. What does it tell you? It's the example of what it means to be inclusive. You have open political institutions, democracy, and you have open economic and social institutions as reflected in low inequality. So that's how I define inclusive institutions in the book, sort of trying to be even more precise than Acemoglu. Now, if I argue that shocks, violence were critical for countries, for actually few countries, we have almost 200 countries around the world, and only 44 of them made it rich. 150 still are poor or caught in quote-unquote middle income trap. So what is the type of shocks that you need to move from one being extractive to inclusive? More or less, it's always about eliminating the old elites. So for Eastern Europe, my argument is, and don't call me an apologist of what I'm going to say, the first shock was the Second World War, which helped to eliminate the old social structure. And the second one, which I don't think anyone has ever looked at before, was the shock of communism, or real socialism, in fact. There was never much of communism in Eastern Europe, perhaps a little bit up until 1956. After that, it was real socialism, but let's call it communism just for clarity. So we all have a view of communism that it did not work, to put it mildly, and for the right reason. It was a horrible system. It bankrupted countries. It imprisoned people. It persecuted people. Good that it died. But one thing that we have missed in that story is that it's actually a system. There was the very shock that all of Eastern Europe apparently needed to remove all of these social structures that kept it underdeveloped for 1,000 years. Never in the history of all of these countries have anyone done such a revolutionary land reform and all the other changes that made the society much different than it has ever been before. Some of the examples, is Pavel here? Bukowski, there you are. Good. This is your chart. Good. So I'm having his chart here to show that Polish elites, the top 1% of Polish elites, just at the beginning of the Second World War, were taking over about 16% of GDP. And immediately after the war, it came down to about 5%, and it stayed there for the rest of the communist period. The bottom line is the elites were gone. Also economically. We also forget that socialism was the biggest investment ever in human capital. In 1960, Poland's university enrollment was 7%, which was equal to France, even though France was about three times richer. And third, talking about social mobility, there was never really much social mobility in 1930s. It really mattered what parents you chose for yourself. If you chose it badly, you would not ever make it. Under socialism, in mere 25 years, 30% of Polish farmers moved from agriculture to industry. That has never happened before and probably never happened again, even if you believe in this fake news about AI and the future impact and AI. That will just never happen. We've been there before. Now, fast forward to 1989. Anyone remembers these good times? I do. I was old enough. I was 14 years old. I remember the good times. We had this super competitive, environmentally friendly infrastructure. And I come from Śląsk, Silesia, so I know what I'm talking about. Beijing today, when I'm based, is like, wow, Shangri-La. We did not even measure the air pollution. I knew what I mean, air pollution. You would measure by the color of your curtains at the end of the day. If it was black, it was a bad day. We had this Dutch-style competitive agriculture. You would say organic today, but it didn't look this way in 89. And we had stores. One of these lovely ladies could be my grandma waiting to buy some kielbasa for breakfast. It was really bad times. Poland was bankrupt. It actually stopped servicing foreign debt in 1982, so it was Greece. It had a total macroeconomic collapse. It had inefficient industry, inefficient agriculture. There was virtually no one, and I've checked all the references, there was virtually no one in 1989 that would put any money on Poland. People would say, the Hungarians gonna make it because they had goulash communism, they've reformed, they're gonna make it. It's gonna be the Czechs who's gonna make it because they are so well organized. Come on, they have Skoda and everything. And these Germans, wow, obviously they're gonna make it. 25 years later, when you look at the data, Poland is by far the fastest growing economy in that period, having grown, actually today, if I updated the data, it would be about 150% growth in GDP per capita since the beginning of transition, beating Slovakia's and Estonia's of the world and beating Eurozone by a mile. Eurozone GDP increased by only about a third. Big difference. And if you ask me, you know, in America, I got these things. Yeah, but in Europe, who cares? All these guys are sclerotic and are not growing anyway, which is not true, by the way. So that's why I have this chart that shows GDP per capita growth since 1995, and Poland is the fastest growing economy in its among countries with a similar level of income, beating South Korea, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, and whoever else you have. And again, that has not have happened before. Poland was not even close. It was actually an economic loser for all of its 1,000 years, every single time. It was even a loser in the communist camp. There was the country that has developed the least even under the old system. Come on. It was something apparently in the DNA. So because of this growth, Poland has caught up to about two-thirds of the level of income in Western Europe, which is, to me, how I define Poland's and actually Eastern European golden age, because all of these countries have actually never been closer to the West in terms of the level of income and quality of life. And Poland also grew much longer than everyone else. Now, why I think it's useful to look at Polish example, it's unique in many ways. It's not Russia, so no oil, no gas story. It's low debt, so all of this development has not been driven by debt steroids. It was not Greece growing because of much fast growth in public and private debt. It was part of slow-moving EU. If Poland was where South Korea is, it would probably have grown faster. And last but not least, Poland has done it all while being a vibrant democracy. From left to right, from center, from the bottom to the top, depending on which parties you like, which is very unusual because all other catching up stories before were never really fully democratic. Asian tigers catching up, big part of it happened under dictatorships. Southern Europe, Spain, Portugal, Greece, big part of catching up happened under the dictatorship. So we actually have the first time ever that a group of purely democratic countries truly made it, or at least made it, that caught up so much. And now this is, that since we have two chief economists from EBRD, I had to have this chart to show that Poland had done something quite remarkable, that the growth has actually lifted all boats. In other words, throughout the whole period since 89, 100% of the society, 100% of the society had increased their incomes faster than the average for G7 country. No other democratic post-communist country achieved the same. Only Belarus and Turkmenistan, but we can quibble about their democratic systems. So, why? Why did it happen? Why did not Poland fail again? In fact, in retrospect, it would have been much easier to say why Poland failed rather than why it succeeded. So I have a list of what I call the proximate drivers of success, which are the list that you would usually find in a World Bank, EBRD, or the IMF report. Because these are sort of somewhat less controversial things, which would say a country adopted policy A and B, and these policies were more effective than other policies. And indeed, I have a big chapter in the book that goes through the post-transition recession, goes through the shock therapy versus gradualism debate. If you want to have a discussion about it, please ask me. But there's a lot of things that Poland got right, including delayed privatization, which always meant that the reason why Polish football clubs suck so much today is because of privatization. We never generated oligarchs that could fund the Polish Chelsea. Not a single billionaire. So Legia is losing to Luxembourg in the Champions League. I mean, how bad can it be? But I'd rather have economic football teams that really play badly than have an economy that is controlled by oligarchs. But what I think is really interesting is not only these macroeconomic policies and structural policies that matter, but is an answer to the fundamental questions. If good economic policies drive good economic outcomes, then what drives good economic policies in the first place? It's not like we don't know how to make countries grow. I mean, you would ask Eric and Sergey, and every country would be rich tomorrow. The fundamental difference is that some countries, even though we have all this knowledge of what to do, some countries choose not to have good economic policies. So what I argue in the book, and I think this is sort of a new perspective on this growth, is what are the ultimate drivers of growth that made Poland adopt the good policies? And again, it's a long story. Number one is this positive legacy of communism, which I think sounds controversial, but my point is it was the first time ever in Polish and Eastern European history where it did not matter what your name is, who you are, and where you come from. It never happened before. For the first time ever, we had an open, socially mobile, educated society that knew where it was going, and a society that decided that we'll create an open system where everyone can succeed. A democracy and open markets. That has never happened before. We had a strong consensus to return to Europe, become Western European, which probably makes Poland different than our friends in Ukraine and Russia, who had a much clearer consensus on what to do. They were quibbling and probably are still somewhere in the middle looking for the third way. Poles had never second thoughts. We want to be like Western Europe, period. Whatever they've done, we're going to have it too. Growth-oriented elites. I've looked at the CVs of every single Polish economic policymaker, and virtually every single one of them has been abroad and educated in the West on Fulbrights, MBAs, and all kinds of educational establishment. The point being that it made Polish elites much different than, say, the elites in Bulgaria, where apparently, up until Simeon Diankov in 2002, no single minister of finance even spoke English, if you know what I'm trying to say. middle class that never existed in Poland's history before, all these young Poles here that they were never there in the past up until 1939, and finally, lucky timing, Western Europe wanted to embrace Eastern Europe on benevolent terms for the first time, send euros rather than send tanks, which is a big difference. Two more things to talk about is, and this is more relaxing because really who knows about what the future will bring. Come on, we can have some good drink and talk about future and we can have all kinds of different views. But you know what, I'm optimistic. I think I've been proven right after 3 years of this particular government, which is that the economy will continue to grow because all of the other things that have driven Poland's economic resurgence are largely there. And it will mean that Poland should be able to reach at least about 80% of income of France or EU average by 2030. It's 67, 68 now, so getting to 80 is not really that difficult. And that would be by far the highest relative level of income ever in Polish and Eastern European history. So golden age would be thriving. And that will be based on all kinds of indicators that you would learn in this lovely school in economics 101. If you have open markets, stable macroeconomic policy, open borders to trade, low debt, then it's very difficult. And high quality of human capital at the low price, it is very difficult to see what would actually stop the economy from growing within open markets because it meets all the sort of basic principles of what makes countries grow, improving infrastructure, business climate, and the like. It's also all these young people in the audience, young with age and young in soul, which is all of the rest of us, because the Poland and Eastern Europe, again, is a proxy, we just never had such a competitive generation ever. That is so well-educated, open-minded, cosmopolitan, multilingual, ethical, and whatever other adjectives you will find. And this is the generation that is just much different than our parents' generation in all kinds of various ways. And these are the generation that will push the country forward for a long time. The golden age is also visible in sports, if you follow. I wish I showed this before the World Cup in Russia. There would probably have been a big echo. Robert is not apparently what he used to be, but hey, give him a chance. And there are some risks, and just for the benefit of time, I won't go through all of the risks. I'm sure that Sergei will talk about them, and we can have a debate about the risks that we know about quite a lot, such as population aging and decline, a big risk, or lack of innovation or weakening institutions. And the single most important risk, which I think is strategic and fundamental, if something happened to the EU, or if Poland happened to not want the EU anymore. I think that's, looking at the long economic history, it immediately pushes Poland back into this dark periphery of the continent where it has always been and where it has condemned it to economic irrelevance. Last but not least, I have a couple of ideas of what the region as a whole, and I have this lofty name of the Warsaw Consensus. I hope our two discussants agree. A list of 10 economic policies, which I think are critical, and I think most of us will agree about them, which I believe are critical for this Polish miracle to be sustained, from keeping institutions strong, increasing domestic savings, which has always been an issue in the region, promoting innovation and education. Innovation is a no-brainer. Everyone will always say it. But being open to immigration, I think a lot of people, actually, there's a big surprise about Poland. 5 years ago, all these smart experts said that, including OECD and Eurostat, in fact, when they published long-term projections for the region, they would actually say that Poland, these people that never smile and the country is so cold, there's just no way any immigrant would ever want to come there. That was pretty much the type of thinking in a footnote. Now, since then, 2 million Ukrainians have come in. Almost 2 million Ukrainians. And I was in Warsaw on Friday, and I took Uber 5 times. So there were three Ukrainians, one Georgian, and one Indian who were in Uber. No single Polish guy. And it all happened over just 3 years, and we have to continue to do that. To summarize, I think it's an amazing Hollywood story of a country that has been an alcoholic for 1,000 years, then sobered up over the weekend and won a marathon. I think it's pretty remarkable. You would never really predict, you would never put much money, you would never bet much on that country in 89 because it just looked so bad that you could only, based on the track record, you could always predict that this country will again be an economic loser as it has always been. Instead, for all these other reasons that never happened before, such as inclusive society, open markets, EU, westernized elites, the emergence of middle class, the country really made it. And I think because of these, all of these fundamental drivers are still there, I'm optimistic at least until 2030. I'm much less optimistic about what happens then, because Poland will have to start moving from being an absorber of ideas to a creator of ideas. And it's going to be a big problem because we've never done it before. And the last but not least, what will matter is for Poland and the whole of the region to continue to be inclusive, to keep the political scene, the economy, an economic scene open, to keep a system that is egalitarian, that is socially mobile, that promotes everyone regardless of where they were born and what they are doing. In fact, exactly the type of a system that helped an impecunious boy raised by a single mom in a small town in the middle of Poland to write this book and present it to you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. And at least I could subscribe to many of the things you said on that last slide. And the most worrying thing to me is not that Poland cannot produce entrepreneurs or that it cannot continue growing. But I think what does worry me is what you had on the previous slide, that something may happen in Poland's orientation towards the EU, may happen in its relationship to the EU. And of course, if something happened to the EU, that could also be bad for Poland. But that's where my concerns lie. And of course, this is not a new thing. There was always a streak of anti-European feelings, particularly in the countryside of Poland and so on. But Sergei, you have a chance to maybe comment on this and put it in context.
Yes. Thank you very much, Eric, for inviting me, and thank you very much, Marcin, for this presentation. I generally cannot disagree with what you said, especially given that some of that is coming from our own transition report 2016. And indeed, Poland has been a growth miracle, and indeed, the recent few years have been also an economic success, with all the challenges and problems that this government brought into the front of the debate. Now, I should say that Marcin was talking about Poland relative to Central Europe and Western Europe. For us, a very important comparison is indeed Ukraine. So if you go back to late 80s, Ukraine and Poland had the same income per capita. Mm-hmm. So think about this. Today, the numbers are three times different. So we are talking about a huge difference just over the course of something like 30 years. And that is also was accompanied by change in population overall. So with all the complaints about Polish demographics, the immigration was higher than emigration, and aging was not as rapid as is, for example, in Ukraine. And so this comparison kind of tells you how two very similar countries with somewhat similar cultures have actually experienced completely different transition. Now, I should say that one thing which I think Poland did very well in the beginning of transition, which people usually don't mention, and which some other countries didn't do, was debt restructuring. This is something that had to be done by some other countries, saying, look, this debt was accumulated by evil communist regime.
Yes.
Why should we pay for this? And I think that was not done in some Eastern neighbors and should have been done by Eastern neighbors, and Poland was very bright and correct about brave and correct about this. Now let me talk about certain challenges that actually underpin the reversals. So indeed, As Marcin correctly said, if you look at the distribution of income in Poland and try to see which decile of distribution has seen increase in income and catch up with the West, the answer is correct. Every single percentile of income distribution in Poland has seen catching up with the West. Now, does that mean that everybody caught up to the same extent? The answer is, of course, no. On average, incomes have doubled in those 27, 30 years. That's a huge number. This growth has lifted all the boats. But to what extent everybody, or at least the majority of Poles, could have said that, well, my income more than doubled? And the answer is, from that very same transition report, is pretty much 20 or 30% of Poles can say, well, my incomes have doubled or increased faster than just doubling. And this is a big issue, right? So when you believe in relative income growth, you suddenly realize that there are many people who've done very well in absolute terms, but not so well in relative terms. And so when we ask people, do you support market economy? Do you support democracy? Throughout our region, the support for market economy and democracy went down. But Poland is a growth champion. You would think, how come people cannot support market economy? And the answer is, well, majority of people do support market economy, but not a very big majority, like 55%. The rest actually says centrally planned system was good, or we don't know. And when you ask about democracy, and again, it's a very vibrant democracy, which has delivered inclusive growth. Overall, inequality has not really increased too much relative to neighbors. But yet, minority of Poles, something like 40 or 45%, say democracy is the best political system. Now, another issue which we look at is inequality of opportunity. Marcin was talking about the importance of place of birth or parental background, which indeed in Poland is lower than in other places. Still, it matters. It's still not Germany. Poland is still not Germany once you try to see to what extent inequality of outcomes is explained by place of birth, parental background, gender, ethnicity, and race. Ethnicity and race doesn't really matter much in Poland. It's a very homogeneous country. But place of birth, gender, and parental background actually does. And so this issue is very important. Now, if we evaluate overall, Poland is being close or far away from our definition of ideal sustainable market economy. This is what we've done after Eric has left the BRD. We redefined sustainable market economy. So we now measure progress in a different way. So we have six dimensions of sustainable market economy: competitive, inclusive, well-governed, green, resilient, and integrated. In those terms, Poland is doing very well, pretty much as well as best Central European and Baltic countries. In some dimensions, number two overall in our universe of 38 EBRD countries. In some dimensions, number one or number three, sometimes tying with Slovakia, Slovenia, or Estonia. But overall, in all these dimensions, Poland is doing relatively well. So things are actually not bad. The question is why the government, which is in power today, on one hand, actively is trying to destroy institutions, on the other hand, is doing so well economically, and why this government is actually in place. And so these questions, and Eric asked me to provide a broader background, is usually related to those issues which I mentioned: inequality, inequality of opportunity, disillusionment of majority of the public that see that their incomes are not catching up as much as incomes of the top 20% or top 30%. Marcin was talking about the young Poles. Here in London, Poles you see here in London are now or are going to be the top 20%. Poles I know, they all speak English, they are all top 20%. Russians you know are also top 20%. And so thinking about how well these people are doing is of course not representative of the overall experience. And part of this story is actually not just about material prosperity, but feeling of fairness. The narrative of this government is not about that economy has not delivered, but the fact that somehow this government manages to sell a narrative that transition was not fully fair. And we run those regressions as well. We run regressions in which we try to see whether approval of markets, approval of democratic political institutions, approval of government in office itself depends on your own economic welfare, on your income, on your employment status, or on your perception that in your country it is the talent and effort that help to achieve success, or connections and corruption. Mm-hmm. And basically, in all countries around our region, actually this feeling of unfairness matters, and in many countries it matters more than income, and in many countries it actually kills the effect of income. So if you are successful but you feel that the system is unfair, you don't support the reforms. And we ran this regression separately for Poland, and we saw that in Poland this feeling is also important. So people who are doing well but feel that the system is not important, is not fair, is not meritocratic, these people vote against the system. And we ran the regression actually before this government came to power. Now, coming back to what and why Marcin is optimistic and should be optimistic about the economy. I should say that our forecast is also great. So we think that this year economy will grow by almost 5%, next year by almost 4%. This is a great number for a high-income economy. Think about this. It is indeed located in a European continent where nobody is growing at those rates, except for much poorer East European countries like Romania or Bulgaria maybe. Even America is not growing at that rate with all pro-cyclical budget policies of President Trump. So this is quite an achievement. This is actually a major economic success. We would explain it, like Marcin, as that the fundamentals are great. So this is a very dynamic and competitive market economy. The government has not destroyed macroeconomic policy. A lot of people you talk to, and again, most polls I talk to are polls from the previous government, right? In the BRD, the economist in charge of Poland is a former finance minister from the previous government. Yeah. His deputy is the head of country economics and policy. And in general, people I talk to have not voted for this government. And these people would tell me next year Poland will run out of cash because how can you hand out cash to every family, 500 zloty per kid and so on. And that's not happening. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why it's not happening, this government is collecting taxes better than the previous government. This is, again, a fairness issue, which is very important. And I'm happy to talk about other countries in our region where tax collection, the understanding that everybody needs to pay their fair share, matters a lot. And this, I think, is very, very important. Now, so far, this government has not destroyed economic institutions and actually has done some useful things. And when Marcin was talking about inclusion, well, 500 zloty policy is not necessarily addressing the issue of poverty, but it does contribute to anti-poverty mm-hmm. crusade. And, of course, we would generally recommend you need to target welfare benefits to poor, not to people who have kids. But often this, more often than not, these categories overlap, they're correlated, and in general, the impact of those policies is actually tackling the poverty problems. It actually is redistributing towards the poor. Now, the next question is, would it be better if this money was just given to the poor? The answer is that, again, the issue of fairness and dignity is coming back front and center. Why? Because if you are getting a handout in a competitive economy, this is kind of a typical American story, you start thinking, well, maybe I'm a second-class citizen. If you are getting money for giving birth to a child in a Catholic country, of course you understand that this is not a handout, but a reward for doing something useful. And you feel proud, even though you're a welfare recipient. I would tell you that in a neighboring country, we have promoted this idea that subsidies of communal utilities should be removed and replaced by lump sum redistribution. And then we found out that teachers and doctors who used to be middle class suddenly become welfare recipients. And that undermines their feeling that they are employed in prestigious occupations. And that actually undermines their support for this reform that World Bank and the BRD would always support in every country. So these issues, which are non-economic, cultural, fairness issues, actually matter. Now, let me come back to the issue of what we should expect from the future. What this government's done, despite Marcin's optimistic views, coming back to Marcin's risks slide, if you believe on Acemoglu and Robinson, you also know that if countries destroy institutions, and institutions are possible to destroy, then without rule of law, without inclusive democratic system, with politicization of business, of course you undermine economic growth. And it takes a while to destroy consolidated democracy, but it's not impossible. Some people are actually now afraid of American political institutions sliding back. And we know that the longer you're exposed to democracy, the less likely you are to lose democratic institutions. And Poland has had a parliament in those dark, drunken years that Marcin has mentioned. But the real democracy, of course, is the experience of just 3 decades. So this is yet a big, big risk. Now, to what extent this government has done what it should have done if it wanted to destroy institutions? I'm not allowed to criticize my shareholders, and so I'll just tell you a theoretical consideration of a modern autocrat. We have this paper with Dan Treisman where we discuss modern autocracies or modern populists. So basically, modern autocrats don't kill people. They don't repress thousands of people. What they do, they want to be popular. And in order to be popular, you need to grab information and money. You need to have media to convince the public that you are doing a good job. You need money to bribe the media or the elites to co-opt them so they don't oppose you. Occasionally, you need to censor people. And we just had a piece of news today from Poland that TVN is unhappy about intimidation coming from the government. But overall, if you ask me what to do if you don't want vibrant democracy and still want to be popular, you need to grab courts so that nobody can sue you for doing other things. Media and business, state-owned business, because you want information and money under your control. So this is kind of the rule book that exists. So I'm worried. I'm worried in the longer run that if institutions don't resist this corrosion, then we may have a problem. And I think so far the risks are yet not. They have not yet materialized, so I think there are reasons to be optimistic. This is still a democracy. We see that local elections have been very, very competitive. But I think this is something to worry about, and this is the number one risk. Marcin also mentioned demographics, and I encourage everybody to read Transition Report 2018, which has a chapter on demographics. Here I'm worried much less for two reasons. One is in many of our countries, aging happens before transition to high income. So Bulgaria is aging. Baltic states are aging. Romania is also aging. And these countries are aging when they're at 20% or 30% of U.S. income level, or Baltic states 50 or 60%. This is not great. If you're aging, you need to have human capital, savings, infrastructure to support the transition to a high-income, aging economy. Poland's already a high-income economy, so for Poland, it's going to be much easier to withstand the challenge of aging. Then on top of that, Poland, like any advanced economy, benefits from immigration, as Marcin has said. And here, of course, Poland's been very fortunate that Ukraine, unfortunately, has not converged to high income in the last 30 years, so it does send many, many Ukrainians. Poland is actually an immigration capital of Europe. People don't understand that, but Poland, I think, has given last year something like 600,000 or 700,000 first-time work permits or something like this, mostly, of course, to Ukrainians. Germany is well behind, so Poland is benefiting from this. Some people would say Poland has lost a million immigrants to the UK. That is, of course, is a problem. Well, Brexit may push some of these people back. But also what we see in this report is knowledge remittances. When you send people to the West, you also see that patent citations come from the very same countries to which you send the immigrants. And in that sense, this is not such a great risk because, as Marcin said, the next stage of growth is about innovation. And for that, you want to have exposure to such economies like UK and the US. This is what we've seen in other innovative environments like in China or India, where people coming back from Silicon Valley have actually contributed to development. And finally, I should say that risks to Europe, risks of Poland exiting Europe, I think are also over-exaggerated. Why? Because in addition to Ukraine, Poland should also be grateful to Russia, which always consolidates its neighbor's commitment to Europe. So that's done for Ukraine.
That's the way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's done that for Ukraine, and of course, Baltic states are fully committed to Europe and NATO, and of course, Poland, and even this government, is fully committed to Europe and NATO. We feel that because, in principle, we have this concept of graduation. When country becomes sustainable market economy, like Czech Republic, it just leaves EBRD as a country of operation. We've graduated Czech Republic. Czech Republic has a graduation diploma. Today, nobody wants to graduate EBRD. Everybody wants to stay within the European neighborhood environment. So no country, however close to sustainable market economy, wants to apply for graduation. They say, we want another European institution to stay with us. And I think commitment to Europe, especially in Russia's neighborhood, is strong and getting stronger, I would say, by the week. So in that sense, I would rather be optimistic. To sum up, there are huge risks, and I think these risks should not be underappreciated. Simply judging by economics today is not enough because the fundamentals have been so strong, and it takes some time to destroy institutions. But I think these are very, very important risks. And we should watch those risks, or those developments in the rule of law dimension, in state-owned enterprises, quality of management and governance, overall in political system, in the media, which is crucially important for today's political developments. I think these are the major risks. But so far, these risks have not fully materialized. Let me stop here. And I fully agree about football teams. I think if you go to northern Italy, to free city states, you don't see fountains and big palaces. Why? Because they had a very different development model. You go to imperial capitals, like Vienna or Paris, and you see lots of fountains.
Yeah.
And so these are the football teams of 17th century, 15th century.
Well, I think you understand why I asked Sergei to comment on this book. So we're going to open it up. I just want to make one short comment because it's something that kind of needs to be explained. So Sergei, you were saying that the attitude towards socialist system or market economy, you know, we find very high numbers in many of these countries saying that, you know, we are not, we don't like the market economy, or we would prefer to have fixed pricing or central planning and so. I think what one should consider there is that there is this kind of incumbency bias in the sense that when you see that the market is not delivering jobs, if you are in a country or an economy that has a lot of market economy in it, you tend to blame the markets. Mm-hmm. If you are in a country where, you know, markets are not very, compare Poland to Kazakhstan, for example. So, you know, in
Uzbekistan supports markets, and Belarus supports markets.
Yes, exactly.
So and privatization.
You find in those countries that want more markets, they blame the state. But those countries where markets are supposed to deliver, they blame the markets. So I think that's just as a background. But please, I want to have questions. Yeah, good. So we'll take three questions at a time. And yeah, you can start there. Since he has already been cited.
So I'm Paul Bukowski. I'm from this building, actually. Thank you so much, Marcin, for this book and for the presentation, and thank you, Sergei, for the excellent comments. I think they're really good. I have one comment and one question. So the first comment actually is about inequalities, and so we are, with Filip Nowakowicz, we have some new numbers on the race of Polish inequalities, and actually, if I may update your numbers, only top 10% of the population has experienced average economic growth in Poland since 1989, This is what happens when you add when you account for the income of the richest people. So actually, what we are suggesting is that the inequalities have been growing a lot in Poland since the transition, and actually, which I would like to get back to the picture you showed, saying that you know the elites been a part of the problem during the interwar period. Actually, if you look what happened with the elites right now, they are the same level as the interwar period. So I think the question is now, I think what will be a big challenge to Poland is actually how to still continue this economic growth, but at the same time kind of limit the growth inequality. But I have now...
On that question, just ask, do you have the comparison also for other countries? Have you done the same inclusion of the very richest people?
Right, so this is basically we follow the methodology which now Piketty is, has this new agenda of estimating so-called distribution national accounts, and so...
But you did it for Poland, not for...
No, we did it for Poland, but you can compare this with Czech. Yeah,
there is a paper by Novak Med.
Yeah, so that's... Piketty. Yeah, so this is for Russia, right? So
No, it's not only Russia. That paper is for Russia, but Novak Med has the whole dissertation, which also covers six other transition countries, but I don't remember.
Go ahead. Okay, so for my question, so I would like to refer here to globalization, and there's this recent book by Richard Baldwin, which is basically saying that, you know, Poland, he actually included Poland as one of those, what he called industrialized six countries. So he said basically it's a China of Europe, where we have big inflow of the foreign direct investments into Poland. We have new factories, which are part of this global value chains. And I think a lot of people actually were associating the Polish growth with the big inflow of the FDI and with the technology the FDI has brought, and also with the increased productivity coming from that. But of course, this was based on the fact that the labor was very cheap in Poland during that time. So, you know, it was beneficial for the to open a factory in Gliwice, in Silesia, because it was simply cheap, right? But now that's my question, what do we think will happen with this mechanism in the future, right? Because we cannot have constantly cheap labor. And, you know, if you believe in your figures, in 2030, will be 80% level of France, so we no longer have cheap labor. And do you see a risk in getting into this middle income trap, where we can no longer benefit from the foreign investments in upper building factories, but we also cannot, you know, keep our wages low, right?
Okay.
Thank you. Andre from Moore Stevens, soon to be BDO. My first question has to do with your graph showed how Poland is catching up to the rest of Europe. However, my question is, how do you account for, let's say, the differences between Poland A and Poland B? For instance, when I visit Poznań or Wrocław, it's basically the same level of development, in my opinion, as Dresden. And my second question, it might interest you as a professor, is when you were speaking about how a lot of Poles are nowadays going abroad to have the, you know, international education, would you say that Poland is slowly becoming a target in itself, for instance, with universities like Kozmiński in business?
Becoming what? Sorry, I didn't
go. A target location for international education in itself.
Okay, there were two people with two questions, but I want to entertain one more. Okay.
Very, very briefly, I would just like to ask what you think the influence of German investment has been in bringing forward the Polish economic miracle. And in terms of the future, do you think you are too dependent upon the Eurozone and that the problems will be with the rate of growth in the Eurozone falling, and that will create problems for Poland and whether or not it's able to develop a sustainable economy?
Okay, you have plenty there to work with.
Yeah, lovely. Excellent question. Thank you so much to everyone. I like the question by Pavel on inequality and the fact that the Polish elites today seem to be where we've been before the Second World War. I think it's a very good point, and that lets me segue into actually, it's hard to say, but commend the current government for what they actually been doing. What I like to say about Kaczynski and them is that they are the bad guys doing the right things. The bad guys is for all the reasons that you mentioned on the institutions.
I didn't say they're bad guys. I cannot criticize my shareholders. You can criticize your shareholders.
I know, that's why I mentioned the things, not how I called it. So on all the institutional matters, courts and media and the like, it's clearly the, I very much agree with the picture. But I think what the global media and some of commentary is missing is the positive face of this government. Because they've actually been doing the things that made Poland much more inclusive and less unequal. And that's been the cash transfer, you mentioned an impact on poverty, but in fact, actually almost overnight reduced extreme poverty by an extent that never happened before. And somehow all the other governments in the past, and I've worked with them, they were all full of great slogans, but they did nothing. The overall problem is that Kaczynski has done things that the global liberal elites are talking about, but are doing nothing about. So Kaczynski have introduced cash transfers, virtually eliminated poverty. He has increased minimum wage. It was supposed to affect the labor markets for all kinds of reasons. It did it. He has made the tax system more progressive and did all the right things for this picture of elites to sort of change. I'm not saying it has changed already. I think it's sort of largely there, and there might be some interesting question about the churn of elites, of who is actually in the top 1%, which is another part of the question. But to me, looking at the whole history of Poland, and I think Eastern Europe again is a proxy, you really don't want to have the situation when this 1% of the elites kind of takes off and leaves everyone behind. And the paradox is that peace is doing the right things to minimize the risk of this scenario. And all the guys that we had dinners with, all the Rostovskis of the world that were ministers in the past, they talked a lot, but they really did not much a lot at all. And I think it's one of the reasons why we all lost elections. On China of Europe, Baldwin, obviously, you have to look at unit labor costs. So the labor costs minus the change in productivity, and ULCs in Poland have been declining for like 15 years. It's only in the recent 2 or 3 years where wage growth is outstripping labor productivity growth, but it's only catching up, sort of closing the gap that developed over the last 15 years. Yet another reason why people felt that they're not getting enough, because the growth was out there, the corporate profits were growing, but the wage growth was actually behind. So if you look at ULCs, Poland is far from being uncompetitive. It's actually super competitive. And obviously the question for the future is, will the labor growth be sufficiently robust to take care of the wage growth? So far, so good. But obviously we don't know how it's going to work later. On Poland, AAB, I just saw the data that Mazowieckie with Warsaw, the central province, has an income which is virtually equal to the EU average. It's like golden age of the golden age. While Lubelski, a lovely student town, I hope you're going to go and check it out, their level of income is about 45%. Now, it's all separate debate, and I'm not probably better than others in explaining where it came from and what to do. My one point is that it's always been this case, and it actually used to be even worse. These parts of Poland used to be the part of the empire that Sergei knows pretty well, and it has not really necessarily turned to Polish advantage in terms of economic development differences between Western and Eastern Poland. And there's just so many things that matter that I don't want to get into this now. On international education, and thank you for promoting my home school, the best business school in Central and Eastern Europe. But I remember 5 years ago, people, including me, were saying there's hardly any foreign students in Poland. Fast forward today, there's 150 plus thousand.
So these things are changing really quickly. And I'm not saying that this is the hub yet, but it's sort of really getting there for all kinds of reasons, including the positive flip side of demographic decline, which is that there are all these schools that have all these nice faculty, but there's fewer and fewer students. So even if they might not like these all these foreign students, they just have to employ them because their employment depends on them being attracted. So, and the last point on German investment and the miracle, obviously, it mattered, and every German euro is very warmly welcome all the time, and I don't think it will change. On Eurozone economic slowdown, it will happen. Obviously, the business cycle changes, but I'm not sure that Poland will necessarily be a loser of the change. I think giving all these strength, I think it should still will, and its flexibility that's in the economy because of junk contracts, the flexible labor contracts, and all kinds of, for good and bad reasons, it is a very flexible economy, and I think we'll deal with the slowdown somewhat better than others. Thank you.
Can I add on some of those issues? So on globalization, I think Poland being part of global value chains, a lot of people now talk about how global value chains will suffer from the trade war. And this is the global debate, global economic debate today. But Poland is part of European value chains. And within Europe, we are not going to have a trade war, I think. So I think in that sense, we do project slowdown next year, 4% instead of 5%. But this is kind of global slowdown due to trade wars where Chinese economy may actually slow down. If trade war doesn't happen next year, then we will probably upgrade our forecast for Poland as well. On labor force, I just looked into our numbers. So one thing to say is adjusted for quality, Polish skills are stronger than the trend line. So basically, if we look at advanced economies, emerging economies, Polish skills are actually good. And a lot of people would say, well, it's all about quantity, but now we have quality adjustment produced by the World Bank Human Capital Project unveiled a month ago. So you can actually build a trend line, and you see that for its level of development, Poland is actually more educated, better educated, as most post-communist countries, of course. But it's not just quantity, it's also quality. Now, the next question is automation, and this is part of this debate about wage increases. So as wages increase, you want to become more productive. As you have demographic challenges, wages do increase because you have labor shortages. So you need to invest in more productive technology. So is Poland behind or ahead of the trend on this? So our data show, well, it's not our data, it's International Federation of Robotics on number of industrial robots per worker. Poland is ahead. Poland is actually above the trend line on automation. That sounds strange for people who don't talk to robots, but I guess you talk to people. You don't talk to firms that are full of robots, but that's what we see. Now, on the changes which are happening in terms of impact of technological change and globalization on composition of labor force, we observe strong job polarization in Poland. Jobs are destroyed in the middle of skill distribution. Medium-skilled jobs are being destroyed, not surprisingly. High-skilled jobs are being added. We don't see decline in low-skilled jobs. Some people would say that's because we don't observe low-skilled informal employment by immigrants. Who knows? But we, at least, we see increase in high-skilled jobs and decrease in middle-skilled jobs. And finally, on minimum wage. So we do have this debate on minimum wage in Russia, for example. And indeed, 101 economics 101 will tell you minimum wage would destroy jobs in competitive markets. Mm-hmm. Now, if you raise minimum wage, that's probably the increase would be too low to affect, to make it binding for Warsaw. Warsaw is a competitive labor market where minimum wage is too low for average wage in Warsaw. But then where it probably bites in towns where labor markets are monopsonistic. And we know, Economics 101, that if you have labor market which is monopsonistic, minimum wages actually add employment and increase welfare. So in that sense, it's not such a crazy idea to increase minimum wages if you have some backward monopsonistic industrial towns. And so if that is the case in Poland, which I don't know much about, I have not been to smaller Polish towns, but if that is the case, then minimum wage increase is not a stupid idea. It's actually what economic textbook would tell you to do.
Great. Next round of questions. In the back.
Good evening. I study environmental policy here at LSE. And so my question is about one of the, I think, very important challenges to the Polish economy that has not been yet mentioned tonight, which is its dependence on coal. Still, like 80% of electricity in Poland is produced from coal plants. And I wanted to ask you, how do you think that might affect future economic growth in Poland, given the fact that this energy transition is very demanded by the EU and the EU binding targets on emission reductions? Thank you.
Very important question. We had a question here. We get a lot of exercise today.
Thank you. Two questions, if I may, very different. One, if you could come back on what you said earlier regarding the unit labor costs, which actually have increased, and the difficulty maybe, do they translate the difficulty to attract more immigration? I mean, there's already 2 million Ukrainians. How many more Ukrainians can you attract? Is there really a shortage of workers at the moment, and will it increase? And a very different question is, what has been the influence, according to you, of the Catholic faith, Catholic Church, in creating this social cohesion in Poland, which seems to have been so important, in fact, in the transition?
Who's next? Oh.
Thank you, Marcin. I very much like the angle that you took on inclusive economy, as opposed to the consensus view that the Polish miracle can be explained by the EU membership. Still, on one of your slides that listed the different success drivers, you put the EU membership at the bottom of the list. So my question is, do you consider it to be the least important driver? And if so, have you tried to disentangle the EU funds contribution to growth over time?
Of course, EU's influence is not only about the money, it's about other things as well. But please, Martin.
Yes, thank you. On coal question, honestly, I've just become vegetarian, so I am trying to make sure that the farting cows are not making it worse. To what extent it will matter, I'm not sure. So if you ask me about coal, yes, I would reduce it to zero. Will it happen? It won't happen. And I don't think it has that much of an impact on the economy, really. It is more about the quality of life and well-being, which is actually number point of my Warsaw Consensus. It matters for, obviously, for air pollution and how people feel and the overall direction of development. But I think it will stay there. I wish the decline would have been faster than what the government projects. And I don't think it will be. Poland will for a long time be dependent on coal, and it will be not moving fast enough. But let me stop here. I'm really not an expert on this. Neither am I on Catholic Church, but I do discuss this in a box and in a chapter. I actually have a chapter on the importance of culture, leaders, luck in development. I mean, you usually don't get these chapters in books because it's just so hard to talk about it. So I look at the religion, I cite some other people that you know well, like Simeon Diankov on the Protestant versus Orthodox versus Catholic and whatever. It's a pretty interesting debate. My bottom line is that the liberals often tend to criticize the Catholic Church for being anti-enlightenment and sort of feudal and pre-modern. But indeed, they underappreciate the importance of the church for creating social cohesion, social trust, a sense of identity, and a sense of common destiny. And I have not run regression on any of these, so I have no clear answer. And my box is sort of very like a pure what an economist would do on the one hand and on the other hand. I have no obvious answer. I think that there were very positive angles on the Catholic Church involvement, and I don't think it's actually that critical, but it's critical to the extent that it affects voting patterns, which we see. And Sergei's wife had these really nice papers on how the partitions, how the voting patterns can be explained by which part of the Poland were occupied by who. But anyway, I think when we also talk about Kaczynski, we tend to forget that there's this one third of the society has always been there. They just never had a chance to be in power for all kinds of reasons. And one of the reasons is that, that's my conjecture, is that from the beginning of transition, there was an implicit quid pro quo, which said that we will move towards the West and we'll adopt all the institutions and values in return for the prosperity that it brings. And all the conservative Poles that would otherwise feel uncomfortable with this direction, they said, come on, if you bring me money, fine, I can stay quiet. But after 25 years, when you have largely consummated this relationship with the EU, the people, I'm sorry, it's just a story. They pretty much said, you know, now that we have done it, our conservative values can come out, and we are really not that Western as you had thought we had been all this time. And these guys have not changed. Our perception have changed, and they just won 37% of the vote and got into the government. On EU membership, just quickly, I put it at the very bottom. It's not because it's the least important, it's because it's the most obvious. And you really want to start lists with things that attract attention. So that's what I put this communist legacy, as I think it's much sort of more original. Obviously, EU membership was the big part of the story. Many things would... I mean, the EU, the way it has become a reform anchor, we are now starting to forget this, but we are doing things just because they told us to do this, and Poland and Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, everyone else, we were translating EU acquis communautaire, making all mistakes, and people were voting this into legislation anyway. It's been never in the history of mankind have so many countries absorbed 500 years of Western civilization in such a short time as Eastern Europe did in the run-up to the accession. That would also made us successful. And I think it's still there, if I may, about the weakening of the institutions. It's just so great that Poland is part of the EU, because if we are Brazil, we would already be gone. Why? Because we have an institutional straitjacket, you know, like in an asylum where something wrong with you, they put a thing on you. And as I think it's critically important. Why? Even now, the Supreme Court in Poland, the reform is being reversed because of the EU. And to me, it's the prima facie example of how the EU institutions work and how they provide the very key constraints and restrictions that made being an EU member so much different than when you are a brick, where if you have a bad government, you're just gone. There's nothing that will keep you from having populist policies. In Poland, it works, including on the deficit, on debt, on everything else. Thank you.
Let me just say on coal, this is a huge priority for the BRD, the green transition in countries like Poland, and in Poland in particular. And Poland is not alone in not being environmentally friendly. I should say that in all of our countries, if you look at pollution per capita, emissions per capita, the communists left this part of the world in a very bad shape. So pretty much double of what comparator countries have. And now, since most of the transition was about developing service sectors, less polluting industries, situation is better. But still, Poland is not alone. I agree on coal, but Poland is not alone on that. But the good news is we are there. We'll keep pushing together with Martin, who's not eating cows. So our great team investing in renewables and not eating cows will do a good job together. On Catholic Church, it's actually a broad narrative that in the beginning of transition, you have this alliance of pro-European liberal Democrats and nativist nationalist conservatives who want to liberate the country from communism, and Europe, of course, is the way to do that.
Right.
And now this transition happens. So I don't think it's only about income. I also think it's about nation building. Right. And once you arrive there, Poland is a high-income country, you remember that you have some differences. And you start fighting over those differences, especially given that you're not likely to go back into whatever empire occupied you for the last couple of hundred years.
I can have one or two more questions. So there's one there. Okay.
My name is Jonathan Mueller. I was economic officer in the American Embassy in Warsaw from 1992 to 1995. So I saw the beginning of this miracle. And the first thing I would say is it was very much a Polish triumph. It wasn't foreign investment was a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator. EU accession came in 2004, but Poland started growing in 1992 and grew steadily from that point onward. Even the association agreement with the EU only think came in 1992 at the same time that Poland started growing, so it doesn't explain it. I agree with a great deal of what you've said, but I'm still struggling. It was a Polish success, but I'm still struggling with what it was about the Poles. You commented on a Western-educated elite, but I don't think that really applied in the 1990 to 1995 period. You had some prominent people like Balcerowicz, Marek Dąbrowski, Hanna Gronkiewicz-Waltz, who were very pro-Western, but a lot of the nuts and bolts was done by people who did not speak English, were not educated in the West, and then you had a political shift where you had Pawlak and Kwaśniewski, who were not Westerners, and all throughout this you had Wałęsa, who was hardly a sophisticated Westernized figure. And I thought you made some very good points about the role of the communists in rooting out the old elite. I think it's easy to get carried away with how sucky the communist system was and miss things that they did, like Poland has paved rural roads, rural electrification, rural telephone.
Do you have a question?
What made it different?
Why Poland? Okay. Great.
You got it. Yes.
Okay. One in the middle and one.
Hanna Jaczyńska. I've got two quick questions and one remark. So question one, the general trend is that the retirement age increases, and ideal retirement age now in Europe and in the world is about 70. So can Poland afford to lower the age of retirement? Because we know that the current government has done that. So the second question, in view of aging society and the fact that we've got 2 million Ukrainians who replace about 2 million Poles who work abroad, what will happen? What are the provisions? Because as we know, Germany is preparing to give them work permits to Ukrainians, and obviously they will leave Poland for higher wages in Germany. So what is the plan to combat that? And the remark is regarding the coal, because I think I remember correctly reading that in European Union, out of 50 most polluted cities, 33 of them are in Poland. So something has to be done about coal and to take care of environment and people health, because I've read the statistics that the big amount of Poles has got cancer. It's increasing rapidly. So something has to be done, not just for energy, but for environment and for people's health. Thank you.
Thank you. There were many people who wanted to ask questions, but we have to be out of here in a few minutes. So can you take these questions and maybe some final?
From the gentleman from the U.S. Embassy, and thank you so much for your support all along the way.
Poland was different, and I enumerate all kinds of ways and it was different than others. My big point is all the post-communist countries in Eastern Europe are similar in having become inclusive because of communism, but it was only a condition that was necessary but not sufficient to be successful. And then I have the whole chapter that explains what kind of economic policies did Poland did versus what others did. And this is where initial conditions matter. Like these westernized elites, it matters because it was a reflection of the fact that the Polish universities were the most open in the communist times. You could actually, even Balcerowicz, he already wrote his paper about the reforms in 1981. If he was Romanian, he would be sent to prison. In Poland, he was just allowed to go on Fulbright in the 70s and 80s, something unthinkable in Czechoslovakia, East Germany, and Romania. So Poland was a different animal. And I think Joseph Stalin was really right about it, because when he said he once said that imposing communism on Poland is like putting a saddle on a cow. And he was right. And 50 years later, it turned out to be true. I mean, Poles were the ones that actually helped to destroy the whole system. So, and the last thing that really matters is that, I have to disagree with you here on this one, Polish communists were not communists at all. Communism as an ideology died in Poland in late 1960s, early 1970s, and everyone would say it, including the communists themselves. And I have quotes from Kwaśniewski and from Miller and from Kolodko and all these people that took power in 1993, they were in many ways more liberal than the guys they replaced. Polish communists were not like Bulgarian, Romanian, other communists. They were just different. They've lost their religion a long time ago. They were liberal neophytes. If anything, Miller, which used to be the concrete communist, like hardcore communist, in 2002 he suddenly announced that he proposed a flat tax for Poland. Give me a break. You know, a socialist democratic post communist is proposing a flat tax. So these Polish communists were just totally different. Communism quotes. Retirement age, bad government, bad decision. Population aging, automation, human skills, lifelong learning. There's kind of no miracles, but if I were in Poland now, I would indeed put even more money into automation, robotization, all the other things which will help us, which would also be a way of promoting technological leapfrogging. So it's good to know we're already ahead of the curve, but there's so much more that can be done, and it will help us with ULCs and all the other problems at the same time. So win. On air pollution, come on, I live in Beijing, so when I come to Warsaw, I breathe. It was like 400 PM 2.5 yesterday in Beijing, so come on. I feel great, and I spend so much of my life in Silesia anyway. But more seriously, it is an issue, but you know, it's a bit of a less of an economic issue. I think Poland will deal with it. It's a democratic society where now, unlike in the United States, for instance, I see no one denying air pollution. In the United States, you have half of the society that denies climate change. I don't think you have these deniers in Poland and most of Eastern Europe, and this problem will be taken care of. And with EBRD support and everyone else's, I think we'll deal with it, perhaps a bit slower than we all expect, but it will be done. So mark words, and let's see each other 5 years from now and check that. Thank you.
Sergei, do you want to?
No much to add. I also agree that lowering retirement age is not sustainable. It's just something that Poland cannot afford. But yeah. So far, economy is doing well. Budget is more or less balanced. So things are great. But in the long run, you cannot afford this. And indeed, one of the options is to admit even more immigrants. And then when the immigrants age, then you just hope that robots will fix everything.
On that note, but
yeah, we actually automated some economist jobs after you left, Eric. We've automated some economists.
Yeah. Not yet the chief economist. But let me, as a final remarks, take it back to where we started. And I think this is why I was keen to have this presentation here at the LSE, was that you're trying to think also about this big question of how does a country move from extractive institutions and exclusive institutions to democratic inclusive institutions. And I think you're right, we don't have very good theories for that, or at least the framework that you work with is not very good at explaining that. And you do offer some, I think, tantalizing suggestions at least, and you point to the effect of the war, you point to the effect of communism as in a sense destroying old extractive institutions, and it's certainly something that we need to think about. Then, of course, the problem with that is that, and that's what Sergei was emphasizing, that, of course, these institutions could also be reversed, and there is some hope from the fact that EU does play that role, and I think there's no question. You pointed to several things that have happened recently that I think shows that this anchor or this straitjacket does play a role still in Poland, and that it gives hope, though the short history makes it goes the other way. So we should remain hopeful that the relationship between EU and Poland will improve, and that EU and actually I think Poland can play a fantastic role in the EU, because there is a lot of experience that is relevant for other parts of Europe, and certainly for also countries in the immediate neighborhood of Europe that could benefit from Poland, in North Africa and in Southeast Europe and so on. So I think you have provided a great service by writing this book, and it's something that should be read by many. So thank you very much, and thank you for such an entertaining presentation.
Sure.